Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the July 31, 2018 edition of Ask a Leader. 98 days until the midterm national elections. No state primaries today. However, Tennessee will hold one this Thursday. They didn't make it easy to find a way to ask an official why Thursday kind of strands out there. Today, big ideas and big enterprises. The marine science is not so much water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. No, it's more like plastic, plastic everywhere. Talking about this expansively will be my first guest, Katie Allen, Executive Director of Algalita Marine Research there in Long Beach. And in the second segment, Scott Lee will join me in studio. He's an engineering researcher at UCI's Advanced Power and Energy Research Program, and about the feat his colleagues and he achieved pulling off the UCI campus off the grid. World didn't end, did it, eaters? It's always a pleasure to take notice of all the innovation occurring under our noses here on campus. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to the show. My guest is Katie Allen, Executive Director of Algalita Marine Research Center, based in Long Beach, California. Katie started out by completing a music degree at Cal State University, Long Beach. She toured as a musician, then landed a job managing artist counts at Warner Brothers Records. For years into her career, her life was changed after watching Captain Charles Moore's interview on the David Letterman Show. Way to go, CBS, that time. She left the music industry in order to pursue a degree in science education and a career in ocean conservation. After 5 years of mentoring from Captain Moore, Katie became Algalita's education director. And during that time, she designed and managed programs that continue to bring real-time solutions. And she transformed the organization's reach by launching an international youth-led movement fueled by more than 100,000 youth in 19 countries. She's multiple articles published around the world and is a frequent keynote speaker at ocean conservation conferences. Katie's strong vision for Algalita's future led her to the helm of the organization. In January 2016, she was appointed executive director, where she steers a team of scientists, educators, leaders, and ocean conservationists. She comes to us from Long Beach, and welcome to Ask a Leader, Katie Allen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as always, we get to ask those little origin stories about how your organization began, including the legend that is in the Captain Charles Moore, founder of the center.
Right. So Charles, I mean, has been the face of this movement for over 20 years now. And so when I first saw him on David Letterman, I had no idea who he was, where his organization, you know, was founded or currently stood. And right after seeing him, I was just so inspired. I quit my job and luckily found out that the organization was in the same city that I grew up in. So it was very serendipitous that I was able to find them and then, you know, really add on to their story and help the organization grow and evolve as it has over the last 8 years since I've been with them.
Well, talk to us about Captain Charles Moore founding the center as well. That's like the origin of the origins.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, Charles has lived in Long Beach his entire life. And for those of you who are familiar with our area or who aren't, we're at the end of two major rivers. And so anyone who lives in Long Beach has always seen pollution on our beaches, on our shores. And Charles first noticed actually the kelp forests along the coast of Long Beach were starting to go away. They were starting to be impacted. And so he founded Algalita, the organization, in 1994 to help restore these kelp forests that were starting to disappear. And he very quickly recognized that he needed a vessel to do this offshore work. And so he had a vessel made. And while he was taking it out in the 1997 Transpac race, he was going from Hawaii back to California. sailed through an area that generally sailors do not go through because there is no wind in the doldrums. And that's actually when he recognized the plastics in the gyre, in these accumulation zones. So that was 1997, came back and changed the focus of the organization. So they no longer focused on kelp restoration, but we became one of the first organizations to focus on plastics in the ocean, beginning with research and then really transforming into advocacy, as well as having very, very strong education component.
And we're going to sort of reach into several prongs about that. So education is a pretty uphill project, as I note such pervasive and seemingly casual consumption of plastics. How are you, Katie, engaging and involving various parties, producers, consumers, and policymakers to turn this juggernaut around 180 degrees?
Right. Well, and that's the challenge. I mean, what we see is it's going to take collaboration across the entire value chain for us to really shift into a more circular way of being. And so what we've done, we actually worked with a partner organization, large organization now, Ocean Conservancy, about 5 years ago, worked to pull together the first industry alliance focused on plastic pollution. So it's companies, different brand owners, plastic trade associations, producers, everyone that's a part of that value chain. For the first time, we have everybody sitting at the table. It's been 5 years. There have been different initiatives that these groups have taken forth, but our role at this table as Algolita is really to consistently talk about reduction, consistently talk about how do we use less, how can we start shifting business models so it's economical to make less, and how can we start shifting models to think about service opposed to consumption. And so that alliance, we feel, has been one of the most important achievements that we have made. We also have engaged policymakers on a statewide level and a local level here as well. Years ago, we helped push through legislation that revolved around pre-production plastic pellets.
In which legislative arena?
This is the state of California.
In the state itself. Okay. Not federal.
Right.
Okay.
The state of California. What we recognized on our beaches here, at least the second most common type of plastic debris by count that we see are these pre-production plastic pellets. So that's how the industry ships. And it's basically the virgin material plastics that then is melted into different products. But we found that they were just being lost. There was no best practice management really happening that was effective. And so, that's one of the largest things that we've done on a policy level statewide. Locally, we actually just pushed through a polystyrene ban here in Long Beach by using data that we've collected off of our local beach with local students. So that's actually the number one type of debris by count that we find on our beach is expanded polystyrene, or commonly known as styrofoam.
Right. And there is a means for repurposing some of that. I'm still collecting mine, so I can turn it into to surfboards, but I hope that Enterprise still Huntington Beach, it's hard to get a hold of them, but there are ways that can be somewhat contained. But how then are you tackling, Katie Allen, this tremendous default of most consumers choosing food and other items with loads of plastic material? There are
right.
choices, but how do you, that's another of those, that of that juggernaut turning around that 180. I just still see so many, many three pieces. I count them all the time on this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the challenge. I mean, as our society, we're very addicted to convenience. It's actually innate, right? We want to conserve energy. It's part of just being alive. Is if you can conserve energy, do it. And unfortunately, in our modern day world, that's convenience and looking at how you can, you know, use something, not have to carry something around, not have to clean something. And so, unfortunately, that's what we're really fighting. It's this addiction to convenience. But we don't necessarily think that plastic should just disappear from society, right? There are many uses for plastic that are responsible, but we're looking at what are the irresponsible uses of what we call disposable plastics, because plastic's not truly disposable. I mean, you can put it in your trash can, and I mean, the chances of it being recycled currently are very, very low, because the market is really going through quite a crisis right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's break that all the way down. People think, oh, I can recycle that. And what we're down to, I think, under 30 or 20% is actually getting recycled, and this mostly is getting landfilled. Talk about that. The international market has changed gradually, but now to a large extent.
Right. And I wouldn't even put a number or percentage on it right now, because things are so, I mean, things are pretty out of control. China was the country that took the majority of really the world's plastic scrap for a very, very long time. And last year, at the end of the year, they said, you know, we're going to limit the amount that we're taking. And then in May, they said, we're not going to be taking any more. And a lot of it had to do with contamination. So you've got to imagine all of our plastics that have food on them, that, you know, it's going into these containers. There's mold growing on the material. This stuff being shipped overseas, you could imagine when it gets there what it actually looks like these people have to deal with. And so they said no more. Now what that means is countries like the U.S. or places in Europe, we no longer have anywhere to send our plastic scrap, and we have not developed plastic scrap markets domestically to be able to really consume that. So we basically have made a material, plastics, that nature cannot digest, and now our economy is having a very, very difficult time digesting it as well.
So it is all getting landfilled, mainly, most of it.
Well, I don't want to say all of it, because we do know that there are probably some markets for, you know, PET bottles, things that typically, if you get enough of it and it's not contaminated, there may be some buyers. I don't want to say 100% is going to the landfill, and that's not the case for every city as well. So everybody's going through a completely different situation because of their waste management infrastructure. So all I know right now is that people are scrambling. We even have, you know, CalRecycle that will hold cities accountable to the amount of plastic that they're diverting are basically giving cities a break right now because nobody really knows what to do. And so you really have to view recycling not through the lens of, oh, we recycle because it's the right thing to do and it's going to save our planet. You have to view recycling through an economic lens, 100%. If the material does not have a market, if the material does not have a buyer, it's complete waste.
There you have it. For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we're all over on the web, the World Wide Web at KUCI.org, where plastics are racking up in piles and getting a little recycling, repurposing. So my guest is Katie Allen, Executive Director of Algalita Marine Research, Rethinking Plastics on the Grand and Not-So-Grand Scale. So between us, we've got a little tiny bibliography for people to rethink our plastic economy. I suggest Susan Frankel. She contemplates these the possibilities in Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. And you talk about Beth Terry's work in My Plastic Free Life. Tell us what moved you in that book.
Yeah, I think what's really amazing about anyone who tries your attempts to live a zero waste lifestyle is that it is achievable, right? It's not something that everybody is going to do or want to do, but the fact that there are people out there who have done it shows that there are absolutely alternatives to some of these products, the majority of them. In fact, the way that our organization views this issue and how to solve it is through three things. We need to eliminate what we can, eliminate what is truly, truly irresponsible. That's anything that would have a functional replacement. So a plastic bag, you can have a reusable bag. A plastic cup, you could have a reusable cup. Anything that you could eliminate, that is a responsible use of material. Now, innovating around what may be challenging to get away from, and that's going to be packaging. So if people want products, for instance, Beth Terry was really great in that she made a lot of her own food, right? She made a lot of her own personal care products. But there are people out there who love some of the products that they have. They love their shampoo and they love their moisturizer. And so if you love that product, you're going to get the packaging with it. And so it's really going to come down to how can we start to inspire producers to rethink packaging and the way that we consume or use their products.
Well, there was, I thought I had a choice. I went to the Orange County Fair Sunday. I brought reusable containers. I know everybody can just have a snark fest with themselves hearing this, but I brought things because I, you know, I had already interviewed the a marketing representative for the Orange County Fair 2018, and you know, and I challenged her at the end of that interview about on a different platform, not this KUCI platform, and I challenged her about, you know, what's the waste stream going to be like after this particular fair, because I could just see all that stuff. Right. Well, it didn't matter that I brought my own reusables because they said, oh no, we can't accept your stuff. It's our accounting system. Every plastic cup we pull out of our inventory to fill up your craft beer, Claudia. So I thought, okay. So I had plastic and I had styrofoam for a snack, and they wouldn't let me use my reusable plate for that. And I was just like in a small state of shock and horror that I of all these people that are proselytizing about, you know, turning this waste stream down a few notches, and there I was walking out with all this new plastic. It's really, really hard.
It is very challenging, especially for people who are struggling to survive, have two jobs, maybe they have two or three kids. You know, unfortunately, it is not a high priority for everyone to be less wasteful. And in fact, something that is shocking to realize when you really think about it is those people who are really struggling to survive with the multiple jobs and they're exhausted. It's sometimes it's not even a matter of people being lazy or not caring about the environment. It's people are absolutely exhausted. And when you're exhausted and you're offered convenience, you're absolutely going to take the convenience.
So there is the challenge with, because they're not going to be able to make their own soap when they come home after their third job. They're going to try to find half an hour to do homework or catch, clean some part of the house or something like that. So I saw an enormous array of articles researching the effect, the latest data, the effect of plastics, for one, on male genitalia. And that is what's it called? Hypospadia. So where the urethra does not open up at the very tip of the male genitalia, but it's anywhere along below there, the tip. And so there are so many findings, though, about the BPA-specific plastic, among others, that the manufacturer, B, the exposure. And Susan Frankel talks a lot about all the tailings from plastic. So where is there incentives to rethink the constituents of plastic?
Well, it's interesting. So right now, producers are not even required to disclose what they're putting into the packaging or putting into the product. So, you know, we could say, oh, it could be BPA or it could be BPS or it could be, we have no idea, because we have no idea what's in these products. And so I think really the first step, and it would be a huge deal, and I don't quite know when or how it will happen, but we do feel like there should be disclosure. They should be required to disclose, because there's really no way for us to understand what exactly we're putting into our bodies. I think, too, that as we're moving forward through thinking about innovation, innovation's not just about, let's create products, you know, that have a great design for end life, or, you know, that'll degrade in nature, but we really need to address these substances of concern, which, again, we don't even know exactly what they are. And so that's one of the things our organization also puts on the forefront in terms of innovation, is we need to have real transparent discussions about substances of concern, because we're literally surrounded by this material and the additives and the chemicals that are put into it. So BPA, for instance, it's not a type of plastic. It's an additive that they put into a type of plastic, and there are hundreds of different types of additives that they'll add for different reasons. So we really do feel disclosure is going to be a big, big piece of the puzzle moving forward with innovation. But as of right now, there's not much push on revealing these substances of concern.
So you are talking, Katie Allen, about collaborating with the Ocean Conservancy. Is that an international organization? Where are they based?
So they're based in the U.S. I mean, they do work internationally. They're the organization that's behind the International Coastal Cleanup. But they're based in the U.S. And, you know, they're a much larger organization than we are, which is good and bad. So when you're small, like our organization and many of our colleagues, you're able to be more nimble. Many times you can be more picky about your funding sources, if you know what I mean. So what we found was that our relationship with Ocean Conservancy was a really beautiful one, and that they're the organization that really holds strong relationships with corporations and the other groups I mentioned earlier, where we come in really as this grassroots NGO, that we're the boots on the ground, we're in the environment, seeing the pollution up close and personal. So, it's been a really great relationship moving forward with them.
So I noticed that the Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, it's pulling into Long Beach these next two weekends. They're also looking at plastic. Is there anything you're doing, any kind of collaboration with them about?
Yeah, so Greenpeace has officially joined. There's a massive, massive coalition of not just grassroots NGOs, but large ones as well. It's called Break Free from Plastic, and it is really a global umbrella that spans, you know, Indonesia, all the way, you know, all across Southeastern Asia to the States in Europe, where there's over 1,000 NGOs that have signed on to basically a charter. This is, you know, what we would like to see in terms of elimination and innovation. And Greenpeace in the last year has really been a strong entity within that alliance. And so I think we're actually planning to do a couple events with them while they're here. I know that they're going to be doing a beach cleanup in Long Beach. There's a film screening. There's a lot happening the next 2 weeks with Greenpeace while they're in town.
Well, maybe I can see you there. I'm going to go visit when they're going to have a comedian night on the, the 12th, as well as they're going to have all kinds of tours. So, but what you and I, we also are going to do our own little bit of meeting. So with our time remaining, what are some areas, Kay Down, that you need shoring up with, ways that listeners can contribute?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, first and foremost, I think for listeners just being aware of what the sustainable way forward is truly thinking about reduction, right? It's thinking about how can, in my own personal life, what are some things that I can eliminate and replace with reusables. That is such a huge thing, and we see people doing this all over. We really do. The next thing, the way people can contribute, it's as simple as sending a letter or a call to, maybe if you are attached to a product, if there's something that you love, it could be, you know, a bag of chips, it could be facial cleanser, whatever. Encourage the companies that you purchase from to think about innovation, to think about what they're packaging their products in. Also, there are so many organizations like ours, Algolita, that we're small and we depend on grants and donations to keep moving forward, and really look for the organizations that are the undercurrent. There are some groups that are riding the current, but there are ones that have really been pushing this forward since the very beginning, and those grassroots organizations absolutely need support and encouragement. So I think that is a huge way to get involved. There are cleanups everywhere. We do them in Long Beach every month. Surfrider Foundation does them all over the state. It's great to get out there and see what kind of plastic ends up in the environment. We're not saying that cleanup is going to be any kind of silver bullet solution. We're looking at systemic change, but we do believe that cleanup could be a great educational opportunity for people to see what kind of plastics are we losing to the environment. So get your kids out there, get your friends and neighbors. It's really, really eye-opening, and that can help encourage people to start eliminating plastics in their own life.
Well, Katie Allen, thank you so much. That's all the time we have. I really enjoyed our time together. Thanks for joining me, and good luck on all these ventures.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
My guest was Katie Allen, Executive Director of Algolita Marine Research, Rethinking Plastics. Stay tuned for my next guest to be Scott Lee, engineering researcher at UCI's Advanced Power and Energy Program, about the feat his colleagues and he achieved, pulling the campus power. Campus off the grid and then getting it back. We'll be right back after a short station break. Don't go away.
Avec les anges sous la mer, berger d'azur, infini. Voyez, près des étangs, ces grands.
La mer. And that's by Ms. Dawn, producing that one. Welcome back to Ask a Leader and to the Cool Factor, continuing this morning, making it impossible for me to handle the equipment in the studio. My guest is Scott Lee, engineering researcher at UCI's Advanced Power and Energy Program, with a remarkable project that came to my attention at last spring's Microgrid Global Summit at UCI Samueli School of Engineering. Scott Lee is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Irvine. He started his career at Cal State University Fresno before coming to UCI for a master's specializing in power electronics, after which he joined the Advanced Power Energy Program, where he now focuses on power systems. Scott currently researches microgrid technologies and how they can be applied to modernize our aging electrical infrastructure. He joins me in studio today, Scott Lee. Welcome to Ask a Leader.
Hi, Claudia. Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been waiting for this for only like months and months, and so finally we're doing this. So here is an email that went out on February 12th. It was preceded by 1 month similar message and a 1 week. Here's the message. Dear colleagues, as a final reminder, Design and Construction Services, in partnership with the Samueli School of Engineering Advanced Power and Energy Program, will be commissioning a new power management and control system for the primary campus grid in approximately 30 minutes, 5 a.m. The new system provides control for both islanded, non-islanded power generation. Commissioning the system is a major and required step towards increasing the resiliency of the campus to a Southern California Edison grid outage. To test and commission the system, the campus will decouple from Southern California Edison under controlled conditions, remain islanded for approximately 50 minutes, and then reconnect. The test carries with it the possibility, albeit unlikely, of an electrical outage to the campus. In the event of an outage, the testing will be halted and service will be restored within 5 minutes. A notification will be sent to the campus community at the conclusion of the test. Schedule Monday, February 12th, 2018, from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. If you have any questions or concerns, contact, and we get the good Vice Chancellor, the Vice Chancellor that sent out the message gives you another person to contact, as usual. And then that was Ronald Cortez's email to everybody saying, we're ready to go off. So,
that was a very official sounding.
Well, I had to make it sound like it wasn't my script. This is the brass script. So when I tell people about this endeavor, they react first in a bit of disbelief, and then they take in the cool factor. So before we get into the responses to the email, let's go to the Energy 201 or Energy 301. What's the difference between resilience and reliance when we talk about power?
Of course, yeah. So they sound like they're the same thing, reliability and resiliency, but actually they're quite different. So reliability is perhaps the easiest of the two to understand. It's simple binary, on or off. If your system's working, then it's reliable, and if it's not, then it's not. And power systems, utilities often use a metric, say the ratio of the two, to measure reliability. Now, resiliency is something almost completely different. It's how much of a hit your system can take and spring back, and how quickly it can do that. So
and hits are everything.
They are.
Hits are fires. They are people hacking in, because they're hacking now into the electrical infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
That's the breaking news the whole week, the whole month. Probably you've been watching it sooner.
Yeah.
But the hit can be an overuse of air conditioning during heat. Hits are all flavors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the campus actually took a hit, a very unexpected source, I think,
a couple years ago.
Yeah,
before.
It was a bird that landed on a transmission line, and it was enough to take the system out for a few minutes.
So how was the resilience? Not so good?
It's the bounce back as well, right? So it was just a couple minutes instead
Correct.
Of a few hours. So I'd say that's fairly resilient.
Yeah.
But in terms of your previous question, in terms of resiliency versus reliability, it's almost a cause and effect. So if you have a very reliable system, a very resilient system, then the reliability kind of falls out of that. You could have a system that's built on eggshells, and if it never fails just because it takes a hit, then it's completely reliable. So it's important to draw a distinction between the two, and we're shooting for both here on the campus, and this is why we're doing these research activities and performing these campus upgrades and demonstrating that we are in fact quite a reliable and resilient system.
And one of the big messages I took away, and it was a refrain everybody used, and it was like this kind of, I don't think it was an uncomfortable joke, but it was a refrain. They said, UCI is its own microgrid, and that's what we're going to talk about how it worked. So, but the refrain was, if you've seen one microgrid, you've seen one microgrid.
Mm-hmm.
They do not transfer.
Yeah.
They're all idiosyncratic.
Right. They're very unique. Every microgrid is a snowflake of its own, if you want to put it that way.
Well, careful with snowflakes. It brings up other messages.
Right. Well, they're very unique. You can have microgrids as small as, say, a camper van with a generator that you take up to Yosemite, you know, when it's not on fire right now, which I think it is. Or you could take it to the scale of the campus microgrid. You know, we have about 20,000 students that we all reside here that all need power continuously. Very critical that we maintain that to be an online system all the time. So, you know, it scales quite dramatically. So when you say that once you've seen one microgrid, you've seen one microgrid, that is sort of true. But all microgrids have, at its core, the same components.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They're solar panels, they're batteries. We've got not everybody has that fabulous cooling tower that we have that's very close to the station there. You noticed that on your way here.
Yeah, that's huge right water cooler. I wish they would just crack that open so we could all take a swim. It's actually quite hot today.
Right now, right here. So all of those pieces there. So let's talk about then what happened here on campus. So what were the responses? And I guess I'll hasten to add that on my way into cranking up the show, I casually asked a colleague who is with the IT division here on campus, and I asked him, so remember, did you get the memo about the February 12th pulling off the grid? And he had no clue any of it happened. So a lot of people had no idea, but some people did. They must have responded to your series of emails. What did they say?
So I wasn't in the loop in terms of the emails. Actually, I believe it was only sent out to faculty and staff. So I'm surprised that your colleague didn't receive one. But
well, he probably did, but people, you know, yours didn't have that little police sort of unit light, red light sign on it, maybe of urgency designation there. I'm
right.
Not sure.
Yeah, I could see that slipping by if it didn't get flagged with the urgent. And, we did a lot of studies, simulations to make sure that it wouldn't be an urgent issue. We were fully intending for this to be a seamless islanding transition. And for, I'd say, 100% of the campus residents, that was the case. When we disconnected from the grid, it didn't impact the power quality whatsoever. The lights stayed on. The voltages
right,
were exactly the same.
Right, you could watch it. If you were able to monitor the progress of pulling off the grid, that meant you had juice.
Yeah.
That was another of the little punchlines
at
the conference.
The campus was completely juiced the entire time, and then we resynced back to the grid, so it's business as usual. So that was a great achievement on in terms of USAID facilities and the research of APEP and the collaborations with Southern California Edison and our industry partners. To be able to island a campus of that size, seamlessly is something that, to my knowledge, hasn't been done before.
Okay, so that was a first. There's all these firsts going on at APEP and the School of Engineering. So islanding, for those who aren't familiar with the term, is simply leaving the conventional infrastructure, and that's only electrical. I mean, it's only power. Can you island with other kinds of infrastructure?
I suppose you could, although it's not as common. I'd say if you had a like the thermal cooler that we had on campus, and somehow you were getting chilled water from another source, you could island in that way as well. But I think as far as engineers are concerned, islanding exclusive means electrical power.
Okay, and then there's another term, and we'll talk about that as we talk about, all the disciplines, everybody that was collaborating in this feat that you pulled off on February 12th, is that there was another witticism at the symposium was about shedding. Mm-hmm. So did you didn't in your email say everybody who's at work from 5 to 6 a.m. Use less of everything, or people that when you leave your office prior to February 12th, before returning the turn everything down? I mean, did you give instructions for people to be consuming differently, or you wanted to see a steady use? A representative use.
Oh, we wanted to see if we could pull this off without impacting the residents in any way whatsoever.
Right.
So we chose a time where the load would be low enough, where we could fully support all of the electrical load on campus, and that's why we chose it 5 a.m. Personally, I didn't enjoy waking up that early to witness it. So
oh, the hazards.
Oh, yeah. I mean, life of a grad student, but we wanted to make this as unintrusive as possible. So we didn't ask any of the campus users to adjust their usage patterns. We did, however, during the course of the islanding, switch on and off some fairly large loads.
We did. Which ones? You can tell us and not have to kill me.
Oh, no, it's fine. So that giant water cooler you're talking about right behind the station, 4.5 million gallons of chilled water, slightly above freezing. There's giant, chilling air conditioning units that chill that water down, about 5 megawatts, I think.
5 megawatts go.
Or I'm sorry, okay. 1 megawatt per motor, about 5 of them. We shut a few of those off just to see if while we were in islanded mode that our campus could support that shock. I mean, to have 1 megawatt go off, let's see, to put that in context, imagine an average family sedan, right? 130 horsepower or something, about 1,000 kilowatts, so 0.1 megawatts. 10 of those back-to-back running full throttle is about the amount of power that would put out, equal to one of these motors. So imagine, just shutting them all off at the same time.
Right. Ugh. So talk about the team, all of the disciplines that put this together? How many people did it take? I mean, how elaborate was this whole project?
It took a village. So there was the Advanced Power and Energy Program, the lab with which I work. We were in charge of the simulations and the analysis and making sure that we dotted our I's and crossed our T's to make sure that we weren't going to run into any problems, you know, via our computer simulations and studies. And we collaborated with Southern California Edison, the local utility here. We collaborated quite heavily with UCI Facilities Management.
Yeah, Wendell Brazy.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of local engineering firms, ETAP, which is headquartered here in Irvine. They make software that analyzes these types of things, and also Schweitzer Engineering Laboratories. They were the system integrator that put in the system that actually controlled the islanding.
Those are private. Both of them are private firms.
They are, yes.
Okay. ETAP and Schweitzer Lab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the others, cast of many.
Oh, yeah, many, many. So I mentioned SCE Facilities, the two firms that we used here, and APEP. You know, actually, I think those might be the major players in terms of those that were present at the meetings in terms of organizing this.
So, but you are in APEP's in charge. So, ETAP and Schweitzer Labs and Southern California Edison, maybe they all took a back seat. They were sort of getting out of your way until you called on them, or what was the
Oh,
sort
no,
of
they were at the table.
At the table, but they weren't mm-hmm. running your program. They were collaborating.
Collaborating,
with you.
Right.
And that's a huge distinction, so that APEP gets its due here.
Oh.
Right. And I mean, just a little bit about that. So, for those of you who've just tuned in, my guest is Scott Lee, engineering graduate student researcher at UCI's Advanced Power and Energy Program, with one fine pickup line. I took a UC campus off-grid and brought it back here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we're streaming all over the web on KUCI.org, and you can find us with our little KUCI handle all over the social media. So Scott, then how much juice in megawatts were running at the time before you went off the grid?
9, I think.
9 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for people to understand, 9 megawatts can power what kind of other enterprises? So
okay,
we know
so,
how much juice that really is.
Right. So let's put that into context. So my previous analogy with an average sedan being about 100 kilowatts, right? So 0.1 megawatt per vehicle. Imagine 90 of those. And our campus can sometimes get up to 280 of these cars in a football field. That's about the amount of area that would take up, all running at the same time.
That's 200. Yeah. That 280 cars running are the 9 megawatts?
No, 90 cars are running.
Okay.
Right. It could get up to 280, let's say if it were a very hot summer day or something. But yeah, imagine that much power, you know, 90 cars side by side, front to back, all just
90.
Running.
That's true.
Yeah.
And they have to have at least 6 or 8 cylinders. I mean, mm-hmm. we're all 8 cylinders just to represent how much juice we're talking.
Oh, 130 horsepower car. What is that? Like a Honda Civic? I'm not
I'm
a car guy.
I'm asking you. You're the engineer in this show. I'm engineering the show. That's the only distinction. So now, when I mean, let's. I was thinking of the tension. We can all remember how famous it is, in 2001: A Space Odyssey. When the famous question, Hal, open the pod bay doors, what kind of tension was going on at 5 a.m. February 12th on your monitor?
Oh, well, Hal came on the screen and yeah. we asked it to island, and then he said, Scott, I can't do that.
No, we promised
you. Yeah,
it's
like,
no,
we need this. It was eerie, Claudia. It was very, almost serene. I don't know if that was the sleep deprivation, but...
Or both.
Or both, yeah. But we show. So from my point of view, I'll give you the play-by-play.
Yes, do.
So I arrived there, you know, with my colleague at around 4 a.m. And there was actually 3 a.m., I believe. And there was about an hour long... You know, just I believe they called it a tailgate meeting, where we just went over the plans that we had been developing over the course of the few years prior, and the full staff was there at the central plant. So
well, that's
in case,
what was eerie about it. Everybody's
yeah,
there
everyone
that
was
early
there
in
that
morning.
Early in the morning. They were all ready to go with the full expectation that nothing was going to happen. But it was nice to have that support staff there physically. Also, SEL personnel were there. Caterpillar, that was actually another company I forgot to... Or, sorry, Solar Turbines. That was another company that I forgot
okay.
to mention.
All right.
Caterpillar, just because it came up on the news lately. Anyways, so everybody was there, and we did our pre-island meeting. And then at 5 a.m., we made the call to disconnect from the grid. Up until then, we'd just been kind of just going over our plans and waiting. And then at that moment, I think, is when the action really happened for me. In that, you know, on the screen, on the main terminal at the central plant, there are these two boxes that turn red or green depending on if they're closed or opened, right? So, you know, when they switched from closed to opened and the lights stayed on, that was probably the most fascinating part of the experience for me. Because
green, green.
Right, right. Green, well, green for open, green. Red for close, I believe is the...
Right, right. But the on the screen is both?
Both green, which means that you're physically disconnected. It'd be the same thing as if you were using, say, a hairdryer in the morning. You unplugged it from the wall and it just kept working. You know, and all the personnel there were like looking around, like, oh, this is weird, you know, like we're not connected to the grid, but here we are, lights are still on, no one's getting frantic phone calls or anything. And then we held that islanded mode for the next 75 minutes.
And that was longer than you anticipated
it was,
to. You
right.
thought, well, let's just keep, I mean, who's making the decision? Oh, we're going to stay off grid.
Right. I believe the original plan was just for 15 minutes, I think, if my memory serves me right, or maybe five.
Approximately 15 minutes was right, in the memo 15 to minutes. Dear colleagues.
Right, right. So it was going really well, and we decided to use the extra time to identify issues that would cause us to, you know, we used the extra time to run a few more tests, you know, switch on and off some of those large motors I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Also to identify a few issues that might have made it difficult to reconnect back to the grid.
Oh.
Because that's just as tricky as well.
That's
right?
A pod bay door of a sort.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it went up to 75 minutes, and then at the 75 minutes, we were able to reconnect back to the grid, and it's as if nothing had happened.
Was that eerie, too, to get back on the grid? Or was that...
For me, it wasn't. For me, the disconnection was, I think, the eeriest
part.
Of
course.
Right.
But to go back on again.
But the plugging back into the grid, I think that was more of a relief.
You're putting your cigarette butt out in the ashtray then.
Right, just leaning back and...
No more puffing.
Sighing, right.
Wow. Well, you're looking around. The thermostats are... Everybody's thermostats stayed the same. All that was going on, you know, around the campus as well as where you were. So I'm just trying to find out if there were any other adjustments that were going on around at all. So, and what did you... when you extended the 75 minutes, so you were trying... What were you tinkering with?
Well,
just to, for us non-engineering types to
appreciate. It was interesting to see the campus load kind of go up on its own, right? As people
are
came
showing up.
Mm-hmm, as people were waking up into campus. You know, we started off at around 9 megawatts and it slowly went up to 10, 11. So that was pretty interesting to see. We originally weren't going to run that experiment, but since we decided to run for the Pulse 85, we were able to get that data, which was quite valuable in terms of judging how well the campus would respond, say, if we were to island again in the future.
Okay.
And as far as the resynchronization, we learned quite a lot there in terms of certain settings that need to be adjusted in order to make that happen. But once we identified those changes, you know, you know for the next time, and it goes even more smoothly. Ultimately, we're trying to aim for an automated system where we can just simply push a button, like a light switch, on and off, island, or
a
reconnect.
A safety kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Safety valve. Well, I guess we got to ask, so probably, were other UC schools, like, right on top of this? They want to know, so how'd it go down? Or they want to try it out? I mean, how much of the technology transfer is going on since the successful feat? You performed February 12th.
So I think there was a lot of buzz right after.
Better be.
Right?
There still is buzz. It's right here.
Mm-hmm. And that's great to hear. You know, it's a very exciting thing.
Totally.
It's, you know, I think microgrids in a lot of ways are the cutting edge technology. They're the building block that's going to allow us to transition from a centralized power paradigm into a network of community energy networks in a very decentralized and robust fashion. So it's great to be able to contribute to making that transition happen. We're currently in the stage of technology transfer We recently submitted a report based on our project here to the Department of Energy. Once it gets published on their website, anybody can go through and, you know, read the full thing. A few papers in the works right now in terms of transferring what we've learned to the scientific community.
Okay, well, that'll be cool
mm-hmm.
to see that. And so, I mean, I just, that one of the punchlines about this shedding was that, you know, the fantasy that, or the snarky humor about, you know, was there a dispensable school that maybe didn't have as much importance as engineering? And you named a couple of other schools that you thought, well, we could do without that.
But
that
was kidding.
That was a joke. No, but I mean, but shedding, it has, it's like a tiered thing, right? So you'd have to shed entire system, or, I mean, lines of energy, or shed whole buildings or compounds and that kind of thing. I mean, that's, shedding can come in all kinds of forms.
Right, yeah. There is a priority. So on the campus, we have what are called critical loads, buildings that, like, cannot go down no matter what. And a lot of times,
including
these,
right here. This station, because we're an emergency alarm system unit here.
So in a lot of ways, this building is a microgrid. I'm sure you have a backup battery system somewhere, right?
Yep.
So if the campus went down, you would be just fine.
We're backed up.
Exactly. So there you go. We're already on our way to a transitioning into a microgrid feature. In terms of load shedding, there's multiple ways you can do it. And I think the first step to load shedding would be simply to increase your generation resources. So if you have a gas turbine like the campus does, you would throttle that all the way up, you know, to make more power in the hopes that you don't have to drop anything. And then if you do have to drop things, you try to drop the less important ones first. For example, those large chiller motors, right? And then you work your way down.
The cooling tower.
The cooling tower.
Not so much chill, but not dispensing entirely with it, but mm-hmm. just turning down the stats.
Right, turning it down. And then you work your way down, and your ultimate goal is to avoid having to shut off any of those critical loads. For example, I imagine the biological sciences buildings, they have a lot of live experiments that are having freezers that need to be on all the time. So I'd identify that as maybe a critical load that you would wait until the very, very last moment to even consider dropping. You know, if you had lights in a library, per se, or something, maybe that's not as important.
Would it make sense, though, to have a system that goes out, instead of saying we've got a silver alert, we got a red or amber alert, what we've got, it turn down your juice alert,
mm-hmm.
as everybody kind of on a very micro level sheds what they're using.
Right. Right. So that kind of goes back towards what are the capabilities of the buildings within your microgrid. So if they're smart buildings and they have the ability to, you know, throttle down, maybe turn the thermostats up a little bit or dim the lights a bit, then you'd want to make a gradual transition. Most buildings don't have this capability in that you can simply switch them on or off. And that, I think, is currently the state of load shedding.
Okay, well, I'm beginning to run over, as I typically am when I've got so much stuff to fascinating material. I quickly tell us, you're saying in preparation for this, you're packing up. Where are you headed so we can wish you well on that, Scully?
You know, that's up in the air. I'm finishing up here at UCI after, quite a number of years, seven, I think.
Oh.
You know, it's just so nice here. But I actually have no idea. We'll see where the future takes me.
Here we go. Anybody listening want to plug in this stellar engineer, then here's your man, Scott Lee. So, well, that was a real, real delight. First, seeing how this was presented at that symposium in March and getting a chance to talk with you today about it. So thank you,
Scott Lee,
for taking the time today. My guest was Scott Lee, and he's an engineering PhD candidate and researcher at UCI's Advanced Power and Energy Program. And that was my wrap. Next week we'll have on labor organizer Adi Briseño. She's co-president of Unite Here, Local 11, a hotel and resort workers union. It's high noon season in Anaheim's happy place on earth over minimum wages. I'm going to leave everybody with a thought. Here, we're talking about shedding power, about this is a fiscal shedding. If the public investment of $25 billion is going into a border wall, what about the money that's going into Los Angeles to San Francisco high-speed rail? think about, you know, where our budget could be going. It's all in the works. Talk with you next week. Thanks, everyone, for listening.